elaborate legislation would be required if Alaska indeed wants to see significant increases in production.
Lawmakers hear a different take on oil tax reform. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, House lawmakers object to the latest version of a bill changing campaign disclosure laws.
I think this could have a daunting impact on legislators.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Lawmakers today opened a two-day seminar designed to give them options and alternatives to Governor Parnell's plan that would cut taxes for the oil industry. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Governor Parnell has set a goal of putting 1 million barrels of oil per day through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and the House last year passed House Bill 110 that detailed the governor's plan for getting to that point. But petroleum economist Pedro Van Meurs said that while the goal was good, the governor's plan won't work.
Of course, it is also my view that House Bill 110 does not even come close to taking a major step towards that goal. And consequently, I think a far more elaborate legislation would be required if Alaska indeed wants to see significant increases in production.
Van Meurs told a joint meeting of the Senate Finance and Resources Committees that to meet the governor's goal, the state must look at all its petroleum resources as a group of options, and it must compete in each of them. He said the state's tax policy must change to recognize new approaches by competing countries and states and to adapt to new companies doing business in the industry. He called for a clear definition of the state's tax policy, with tax regimes for each of the various types of resources in Alaska. He's just completed a study of worldwide competitive markets and found that Alaska is the only government with a single tax policy covering every product.
For all these countries, nations have defined what the fiscal system for gas is. Alaska is the only jurisdiction that has not defined at least viable terms for gas. Also, of course, although there are terms for light oil, there are no terms for heavy oil, and there are no terms for shale oil. If you go to any of the competing jurisdictions of Alaska, there are terms today for these resources.
He says the absence of separate tax regimes is a major obstacle for companies that might be willing to invest here. He also explained the importance of considering the total amount of money governments take from producers. In light oil production, Alaska is somewhere in the middle of most of the field. However, Van Meurs said governments take different amounts for different products. Since the state uses a single tax system that changes all those products into an equivalent amount of oil, the state is not in the international competition. He has specific goals, ranging from the government getting 70% to 75% of light oil, 55% to 60% of light heavy oil, ultra-heavy and shale oil come in at 45% to 55%, and natural gas from 45% to 60%.
That is the levels of government take. If you achieve that in your legislation, I think with those levels, you will be competitive for each of those resources in the international arena.
The Senate has scheduled one more day for the seminar. By its conclusion, Van Meurs says he will have presented an overall framework for a complete tax regime for the state. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A bill easing a requirement for certain political candidates to file campaign financial disclosure reports electronically hit a snag this afternoon. House Bill 311 passed the Senate this morning, but a change to the legislation was rejected by the House of Representatives. While the bill has garnered virtually no attention, it is opposed by staff of the Alaska Public Offices Commission, the agency that oversees disclosure of campaign financing. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
The House version of the bill, which passed on Friday, would delay the electronic reporting requirement by 1 year to February 2013 and exempt candidates who have no computer or broadband internet access at their home. It would also prevent the Alaska Public Offices Commission from changing the manner or format of reporting requirements during an election cycle. The Senate wanted to go further, preventing APOC from making changes to reporting requirements for sitting lawmakers during the tenure of their term in office. But Anchorage Republican Representative Mike Hocker said that was taking things too far.
Speaking with many members of this body, that is perhaps a bit aggressive, perhaps a bit strident.
The House rejected the change 33-0. If the Senate does not agree to drop it, the two sides will hash out their differences in a conference committee. The bill breezed through both chambers ahead of a Wednesday deadline for candidates to file their first financial disclosure statements of the 2012 election cycle. Senate President Gary Stevens, a Kodiak Republican, said some lawmakers have had difficulty with the new electronic reporting system being implemented by APOC.
I think this could have a daunting impact on legislators. I mean, I'm in my 12th year in the legislature. I've always sent these things in, mailed them in, and I've always typed them out so they're easily readable, easily scannable, and are available the next day to the public. I know others hire people to do this for them. That shouldn't be the case. You shouldn't have to go out and hire someone to do this report for you. We should be able to do it ourselves.
The legislature put the electronic filing requirement on the books with the 2007 Comprehensive Ethics Reform Act, though it hasn't been enforced while APOC staff worked to get the system up and running. APOC Executive Director Paul Dauphiné says his staff has been working for more than a year on the system and held several candidate training sessions to walk people through the process.
We've had, you know, all kinds of trainings where people were there in person. They can attend via GoToMeeting, and they can attend via just a telephone where they can listen in. We've trained over 300 people.
The law already provides an exemption to the electronic reporting requirement for municipal candidates in communities with less than 15,000 people, as well as candidates who have an emergency or who don't intend to raise and spend more than $5,000 during their campaign. Dauphiné says HB 311 weakens transparency by broadening the exemption for candidates who have no computer or internet access at their residence.
All the money that's been spent on trying to bring electronic filing to bear, something that 34 other states in the union have mandatory for their candidates, in many cases it's going to be optional now. And I would say in a large number of cases, it will not be required.
Dauphiné expressed his concerns to the House State Affairs Committee last week and the Senate Rules Committee on Monday, but members pushed the bill forward, pointing to a requirement that APOC staff post copies of the disclosure forms submitted in alternative formats to the Commission's website within 2 days of being filed. Dauphiné says staff will not be able to catch mistakes that would be flagged by the electronic system, and those documents won't be as easily searchable.
Particularly toward the last few days of a primary or a general election or a municipal election, it makes it more difficult with all kinds of candidates filing to get those reports up in a timely manner. Then it's very difficult for the public to put the pieces together, because when we scan a document, it's a PDF, and that's all you see. You can't look at it in relation to another. It's not on a database where you can put the last report with this report and see how the money flows.
The Public Offices Commission itself has not reviewed HB 311 or given the legislature any input on the bill. Dauphiné speaks for the commission's staff, which is responsible for investigating campaign disclosure complaints. The full Senate will convene on Tuesday and can either agree to drop its proposed change to the House bill or appoint members to the conference committee. The House Conference Committee members are Hawker, Anchorage Republican Craig Johnson, and Juneau Democrat Beth Curtula. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The Public Offices Commission will meet tomorrow at 10 a.m. at the Anchorage APOC office to discuss House Bill 311. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new bird observatory takes shape in Haines.
We get almost 300 different species coming through here in and out at different times of the year.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com, and by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Police say they haven't made any progress in the search for missing barista Samantha Koenig, but her friends and family held a vigil for her in Anchorage over the weekend. Daisha Eaton, KSKA's Daisha Eaton, was there and filed this report.
That's the Samoan Seventh-day Adventist Youth Choir singing at a candlelight vigil for Samantha Koenig in Anchorage Saturday night. Hundreds of people gathered in Town Square downtown to pray for the 18-year-old barista that police say was abducted from the coffee stand where she worked. City Church pastor Richard Irwin spoke at the event, drawing a connection between Koenig's kidnapping and the culture of violence against women in Alaska.
This is the reminder right here, this gathering, for us to be able to say, enough is enough. We're not going to put up with abuse any longer. We're not going to put up with harm brought to the citizens of our city and our state. Victims so often have lost their voice. People who are abused have lost their voice. It's time for you to step out and to be a voice. It's time for you to be the one who stands in the gap where somebody else doesn't have the strength to. Anchorage must be a safe place for all the Samantha Koenigs.
Koenig disappeared on the night of February 1st. Video footage from a security camera at the Common Grounds coffee stand shows her being kidnapped by an unidentified man. A reward is being offered for information leading to her whereabouts. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The state is beginning another round of public workshops to review proposed animal care standards. The sessions, which begin this week, focus on standards specific to different types of animals, including horses, livestock, birds, dogs, and other domestic pets. State veterinarian Robert Gerlach says opinions and comments gathered during the first round of meetings last year are the jumping-off point for the upcoming sessions.
After reviewing all those and making some adjustments to the draft document, we decided to go ahead and put that draft document back out again and go back and look for additional comments and concerns from people in the state.
Gerlach says the state has received a lot of public feedback on the proposed regulations. He says much of the input has been on horse and dog care.
The dog owners were concerned about looking at the confinement of dogs, as well as sanitation issues for cleaning cleaning the area around the kennel areas where the dogs are kept. With respect to the livestock and horse industry, there are a lot of people that have free-ranging animals, and there are a lot of people that may not understand how these livestock animals are out on free range and can survive and do very well even in the harsh Alaskan winters.
Gerlach says state statutes require that standards developed for sled dogs not override those held by established Alaska mushing organizations. The new standards are in response to both in-state and national pressure. Gerlach says most Alaskans take good care of their animals, and the standards are designed to address the few who do not. Alan Moore is still leading the Yukon quest. He left the Braeburn checkpoint late this afternoon, followed by Hugh Neff less than 45 minutes later. Mushers have to rest 8 hours at Braeburn before covering the final 100 miles to the finish line in Whitehorse. Hugh Neff also had to serve out a 30-minute penalty for leaving behind his axe earlier in the race. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, Neff has his work cut out for him.
Even though his was the first team to leave CarMax, Hugh Neff got caught about an hour or so down trail in the middle of the night.
And the worst thing for me would be to have a headlamp behind me for 10 hours. I think I'd go nuts. You can stress out another dog team if you're behind them, because those dogs are going to be looking back the whole time.
So Neff stopped to snack his dogs, and the two competitors didn't see each other again until they pulled into the Braeburn checkpoint as the sun was just starting to rise. Moore is wearing bib number one.
Well, it's worked so far. Just keep the karma coming.
He's gotten very little sleep in the last 4 days. He says the mandatory layover in Braeburn could be a major factor in determining the outcome of the race.
Right now I'm feeling subpar. Hopefully we can get at least 4 hours in this 8-hour period, and we should feel like Superman or something. The dogs also, I mean, they have gotten very, very little rest. Like all these long runs, 9, 10-hour long runs, they've only had 2 hours rest. So for them to get this much, they're going to, hopefully they'll be fired up.
But Hugh Neff seems to think Moore's is the team to beat.
It's going to be hard, obviously, because he has such an experienced team, and those guys really have those dogs trained up well.
Neff's dogs aren't new to the trail. There's not a single one on his team that hasn't run the Yukon Quest at least 3 times.
Yeah, but they sort of cancel each other out, you know?
Neff says because both teams are so strong, he may not be able to make up the time he'll need to overtake Moore.
So if it was 10, 15 minutes, a little bit more doable. 40 minutes, pretty tough.
The trail ahead is notorious for overflow and temperatures are again warm. There's no telling how the teams will react to each other should they meet on their way to Whitehorse. Reporting on the Yukon Quest Trail in Braeburn, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
The archives of Sheldon Jackson College in Sitka are now in the hands of the state. When the college closed in 2007, the Board of Trustees worked to pay down its debt and divest itself of the campus. But lately, the board's work has centered on preserving the historic school's legacy. Under a deal signed last month, the state's Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums will take control of thousands of pieces of material once belonging to Sheldon Jackson College, everything from historic documents to a mammoth tusk presented to the college as a gift. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more on the archives and their future.
Stratton Library is nearly empty. Discolored rectangles of carpet sit where the bookshelves used to. There's a musty smell, like the doors haven't been opened in a while. But up on the second floor, tucked away in a back room and covered under plastic, are treasures from a century of Alaska history.
So there's a file cabinet over here that has student records that go back to the first high school students, 1917, 18, 19, and 20.
John Holst works for the Board of Trustees of Sheldon Jackson College. The items in this room go far beyond student records and range from the clearly historical, like the desk used by Sheldon Jackson himself, to the completely unexpected.
Mammoth tusk from the Kotzebue Sound area presented to Sheldon Jackson College.
And there's no date on it.
There are portraits of school luminaries and tributes to school sports stars, like a plaque that Holst finds listing off the school's Basketball Hall of Fame.
Where's Walters?
Walters right here.
Yeah, Walter Soboloff, who...
Cyril George, is that
who just... This was 19... He was in high school in 1928.
Soboloff became a respected Tlingit elder and spiritual leader before his death last year at age 102.
I mean, this room is just filled with things like this that are... I mean, looking at report cards of kids from... who lived in the 1917, 18, 1920. It's just I mean, it's just fascinating stuff.
The room is so full that a rough inventory completed this past summer takes up 220 pages. And that's just what's here. Within 6 months of the college closing back in 2007, many of its records were sent to Juneau for safekeeping. They and the pieces that remain on campus will eventually all be housed in Sitka. Bob Bangert is chief curator of the State Museums. He says the list of what's in the room is exhaustive, but state archivists will still have to take a look at the items to get more specific information and figure out how each fits into the history of the college.
To be honest, when you start delving into it, you know, maybe 10% actually has focus, and then there's 90% that's like, I'm not sure, but this is important, and you feel it.
Bangert and Holst both say that Sitka residents have been involved in the process throughout. At a public meeting last year, some 40 people weighed in on what to do with the archives. From that group came a committee of five, called the Sheldon Jackson Legacy Committee. Holst says they unanimously endorsed turning the archives over to the state. The acquisition of the archives is another step forward in linking Stratton Library to the neighboring Sheldon Jackson Museum. The state purchased Stratton in 2010 for about $2 million. Bangert says the second floor of the library will be turned into a storage vault for the materials to make sure that they're preserved. He projects at least 5 years before that project is complete. The building, he says, needs some work.
It's a building and built in 1974. There is no insulation in the walls. It's a single glazed window structure. I mean, when we did have the heat on, I'm looking at the oil bill going, I can't sustain this.
The state will pay for architects and engineers to come up with a way to improve Stratton and make it sustainable. Bangert says Stratton itself will eventually become an expanded collection space for the neighboring Sheldon Jackson Museum, which will also encompass the archival material. And he says having Stratton Library as part of the state's museum system will allow museum officials to experiment on a small scale here with ideas that maybe can be used across the entire system. He says it's possible that the combined SJ Museum and Stratton Library could even host a curator training program of some sort. Holst says that notion, that this could be more than just an archive, is what appealed to the trustees.
They saw this as economic development, basically. I mean, bringing programs here to Sitka that don't currently exist anywhere else, and those are things that are very, very, very good for this community and for this building and the campus.
As for the archives themselves, Holst says there are some items that will be preserved but not made public right away. For example, some minutes of Board of Trustees meetings from the last 5 years. Other items, like personnel files and employment papers bearing Social Security numbers, have been destroyed, in keeping with standard practice most employers use. State archivists will have a lot of material to sift through and a long history to learn. Bangert says there will be discoveries along the way, including some that might even be personal.
I taught here in 75, I guess, that summer. I taught at the Fine Arts Camp, and I was kind of looking at some of the stuff from that period saying, yeah, I bet I'm in some of these pictures here. Let's see what happens. But so, yeah, that's the best part of this business is what's not apparent until you really start digging in.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Bird enthusiasts in Southeast Alaska want to make Haines a center for bird research by establishing a station that will band birds and scientifically monitor bird migration patterns. From member station KHNS, Tara Bicknell has this from Haines.
There's only one scientific bird observatory in the state of Alaska, a gigantic state that hosts birds from all over the Western Hemisphere during their migration. The group in Haines says that's not enough. The Tokchinook Watershed Council, which has been involved in research in the Haines area for about a decade, is forming the second bird observatory in the state.
A bird observatory does bird research of a variety of types of things.
Pam Randles is education director for the council.
And for our first project, what we want to propose is songbird migrations coming up in the spring and down in the fall.
She says the observatory they plan to establish and the professional bird handlers they plan to train can document what local birders have casually noted for years as they observed various species returning to the area each spring.
We've noticed just sort of ad hoc observations that there are different species coming up now. And so this is a way to sort of scientifically make sure that we're not imagining things. And then in the fall, when they go south, you can tell which ones are breeding. which ones have kids that are headed south. So if they're just coming up sort of accidentally, they got blown up with a storm, that's one thing. But if they're coming up and nesting, that's a substantial change in range.
The Audubon Society has been documenting North American bird migration data for more than a century through programs like the Christmas Bird Count. The organization says analysis of this citizen science data has revealed that 58% of observed species have significantly moved their range northward over the last four decades, some as much as 300 or 400 miles, adds Randles. But she says there aren't sufficient research stations in the north to study that alarming trend further.
There's only one observatory in Alaska, and that's in Fairbanks. And so they get birds from all over North America, and they can't split out which ones come from the west and which ones come from the Midwest and which ones come from the east. So between the Yukon Bird Observatories and us being on the other side of the mountains, we can kind of help with that information.
The envisioned station would be at the Nelson Homestead in the Mud Bay area of Haines, be equipped with bird research materials and permitted bird banders and volunteer handlers. Those people would work together to catch birds in mist nets, record data, band the birds with small bracelets, and release them. To many birders, Haines is already on the bird map, with its Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve, Bald Eagle Foundation, and annual Bald Eagle Festival that occurs during the fall gathering of thousands of eagles at the confluence of area rivers. In fact, Randall's group already has received interest in conducting eagle research. Plus, it's a great spot on bird migration routes.
It's a good flyway. The Pacific flyway birds, a lot of them come up and they shoot up the Chilkat River into the interior, a lot of the Pacific ones and the Asian ones. And Haines is really a good area for birding anyway because it's an edge. And ecosystem edges are the most, where you find the most different kinds of species. And so while in the wintertime we think of it as the usual suspects, the chickadees and the ravens and that kind of stuff, we get almost 300 different species coming through here in and out at different times of the year. And we've got species seabirds, we've got land birds, we've got mountain birds, we've got valley birds. So we really do get quite a selection.
Randles has been volunteering in this line of work in Fairbanks and apprenticing in the Yukon with fellow birder Mario Benassi, who's also pursuing his banding permit for the future station. Randles says the local observatory will require the help of many volunteers. In Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Tara Bicknell in Haines. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.